My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome to this week's episode of Mysteries and Monsters. Well, I'm sure we've all signed up to Storm Area 51 on the 20th of September, and everything will work out just fine. I mean, what's the worst that can happen storming a heavily armed military base? We've had some great feedback about our special bonus issue with Spiros Malaris, covering his infamous alien autopsy video, but I did get one email accusing me of being part of the alien cover-up, which has really made me chuckle this week. Anyway, today's episode focuses on one of the most compelling and well-known reoccurring Bigfoot encounters in modern history, the Sierra Sounds. I'm joined by Ron Moorhead, who has kindly supplied some of the clips to share and discuss on the show, so make sure you don't listen to this episode in the dark. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, as well as supporting us through Patreon. You can also email us with any feedback or guest suggestions to mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com. And now, let's join Ron to discuss his search for Bigfoot. My guest tonight is one of the leading researchers into the Bigfoot phenomena, and is synonymous with anyone who has any interest in Bigfoot and has heard the Sierra Sounds. Ron Moorhead's life changed forever after a camping trip in 1971 hunting with friends in the Sierra Mountains. Whilst they were there, they were following up reports of alleged Sasquatch activity. What was recorded was like nothing else we've ever heard. And all these recordings have been scientifically analysed beyond reasonable doubt. Ron, I am absolutely delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate being on.
Absolutely. So, throughout your life, Ron, I mean, obviously we're all aware of the Sierra Sounds and how that actually started. I mean, here we are, you know, the best part of 50 years on. Have you been amazed by the continued interest in what started back in 1971, or did you see it as a natural progression?
No, I'm kind of amazed. We had no idea at the time when this was going on with us in the remote area, this mountainous area, that this would be as significant as it is. We thought we were just dealing with some kind of unidentified ape out in the woods, and that's what a lot of researchers still think. But they're more than that, and I got into studying it then, where giants came from, all the mythology behind giants, from Greek mythology to biblical mythology, and just started studying it, and I started interviewing people, and started giving my presentation a few years later with Alan Berry.
Yeah, I mean, when you set out on that trip back in 71, Ron, did you have a burgeoning interest, because obviously it was in the aftermath of the Patterson-Gimlin film and things like that, or had you kind of been into the subject prior to that and it just kind of give you more encouragement to get out there?
No, none of us were. It was a hunting camp. That's what we were doing there, is hunting. And it wasn't until these things started coming into our camp after dark and started milling around and taking what food we might have left out. And Warren and Lewis Johnson were the first two to notice this. They were up there by themselves earlier that summer in 71, and they thought at first it must be a bear. They're avid hunters. They've been in the camp. The camp's been there since the 50s, so they've been there a long time. And anyway, they thought it was a bear until they realized these sounds are not coming from a bear. They're making some kind of ruckus out there. So after it did slow down and stop, I should say, later on in the night, they went out with the flashlights and noticed a big five-toed huge footprint in the mud. Then they realized there's something else going on here. So they came out and told the rest of us, and we ended up going back, and we took tape recorders with us just in case, and we started recording the sounds that these things come, because they were coming in almost nightly in the early 70s. And it wasn't until 72 till we got Alan Berry, our investigative reporter, to come up. And I don't know if you want to get into that right now, but he was coming up there to really try to uncover a hoax. He thought it was probably a hoax. Warren Johnson had written a 23-page letter to Ivan Sanderson. Mm-hmm. And Ivan Sanderson is a well-known deceased now, but cryptozoologist. Mm-hmm. He forwarded the letter to Peter Byrne in Oregon, who is also a researcher and was in Oregon at the time. Also, he thought it was probably a hoax. It's just too incredible what we was telling them, that these things were around. We've been getting glimpses of them, and so they just couldn't believe it, because most people see them running behind their car or something, you know, 20 years ago, and they got some kind of account they want to tell you about like that. And nobody hardly ever has repeated encounters like we have, like we're having. So anyway, Peter Byrne contacted Alan Berry, who was an investigative reporter in Northern California, who came down and interviewed us each. And we ended up inviting him up. That was the winter of 71, actually. He went up in 72, and he took his recorder, too, and was still trying to find out who could be pulling this off, because we're 8 miles into the wilderness. I mean, it's a really imposing trip to get there. It's really taxing, and I mean, I've had a few broken ribs different times over the years, just going off the edge with my horse, or my mule pulled me off or something. So it's not an easy trip, and not for the faint of heart. The camp itself is 8,400 feet in elevation. We leave about 6,000 feet, but we have to climb up and over ridges that are 10,000 feet, right about tree level. So it's a you either have to walk in or ride horses. We packed our supplies in by mules, and that's what we did then. And it was a lot of fun, a lot of excitement going on, but we totally underestimated what we were dealing with at the time. And it's just an incredible story, really.
Well, I mean, it is. I mean, I think that's the one thing that a lot of people don't realize, and I've seen you refer to this at the time. Do you think that, I mean, all of the guys that went on the original trip were all experienced outdoorsmen, weren't they, Ron? You were all used to hunting. You were all, you know, you knew the woods and the terrain. As far as you were all concerned, prior to that visit, you knew everything that was out there.
Well, I didn't. They did. they knew the country very, very well. I began going in 71 when... They came out and talked about it, and I was friends to them all, but I, at that time, I really wasn't a hunter. But that's what I started doing when I started going up there with them, is I got me a rifle and a sidearm, and we went hunting. And that's what we did up there, not with sidearms, but those are for this self-protection from the bears or from rattlesnakes. I got a 52-inch rattlesnake up there one time, 9.5 buttons on it, and he's now on one of my hats. But... I usually take a sidearm with, some birdshot in it, which is good for snakes if they're on the trail, if they're snapping at you or something. So they can scare a horse, and they can upset your day a little bit.
Absolutely, very much so. I mean, so had this area had any kind of reports prior to you? You know, obviously your colleagues were aware of it, but had there been a history of sightings or alleged noises coming from this particular area, or was it a complete surprise to everybody at the time?
A complete surprise. And we had none of the guys were looking for Bigfoot up there. They didn't have any knowledge of Bigfoot. Neither did I, other than the Patterson film, which we just knew a little bit about. We didn't follow it, though. It just wasn't, I was told when I was, because I was a kid, a young man anyway, there was just a wild Indian running around the woods up in Northern California, but that's what most people thought. So, but that's proven out to be a little bit different too. So,
yeah, absolutely. So, how long was the original trip for? How long were you guys planning to be out there up in this camp?
Oh, it depends. We went several times during the year. Hunting season was a big time when we all gathered up there, all six of us, and that's when we would all be there, and these things would come around even then. And but during the summer, sometimes you could stay 3 or 4 days. It's a long trip in, so you can just, it's really hard. And I think I've only did it once or twice going in and coming out the next day. especially if you're walking or if your horses are not in good shape, because it's hard on their muscles, it's hard on their lungs, it's hard on everything if you don't rest up for a day. So we generally make it 3 days, and there's times when you spend a whole week up there, and I've done that. So
yeah, I mean, that also adds to the aspect that you mentioned there, when Al Berry came with you, because obviously you weren't aware of it at the time, but he was setting out probably with the intention of proving that it was, you know, somebody hoaxing or it was you guys perhaps exaggerating or something.
Absolutely.
But yeah. The remoteness of the location would suggest that for anybody to even attempt that would be foolhardy at best.
Ludicrous is another word. David Pilates, who just released a Hunting Missing 411, The Hunters, He just did an episode with me in that film, which shows the camp a little bit, and it's well done, I think. I was at the premiere showing here just a couple weeks ago back in Denver. It's ludicrous, and he says it too, because he had to get in there with his cameraman. And there was, this is ridiculous. No one could trick you guys back here at this. I mean, you'd have to be something very, very special to make that happen and not leave any evidence that it happened. And that's what Al Berry was looking for. He was looking for evidence that somebody was hoaxing us. One of us maybe out there rigging up traps or some kind of sounds or something. But that's why he had those sounds studied at the University of Wyoming, a year-long study there by Professor Curlin. And he determined that the sounds were not manipulated. These were original sounds made at the time of recording. They were not pre-recorded or re-recorded or altered in any way. And that was a big deal, because people was ridiculing Al when you go to professional somewhere to get the sound analyzed. They thought he was pulling his leg, because they say, well, that's somebody playing sounds backwards or it's some human manipulation. But no, that's not the way it was. We knew they were chattering amongst themselves up there, and their aggressive sounds were, we didn't know if they were pointed at us or pointed at each other, but there were some pretty aggressive sounds in 71, 72, and on in, and it wasn't until 74 when they were really getting friendly with us, or exposing themselves a little bit. That's the night I got to see one, because they're very, very fast, and they're very stealthy, they're very elusive. But anyway, we did have later on in years a cryptolinguist named Scott Nelson in 2008 heard the sounds by accident on the BFRO.org website. And he said, I got to find out who this is, because he was trained by the military for a 20-year service as a cryptolinguist to identify and to transcribe unknown languages. And he said, this sounds like these things are talking in a language. So he came out and interviewed Al Berry and myself both, and went back and studied them and listened to them, got the context from us of when the sound happened, what was going on then, and transcribed a language. And that was another big hurdle. But there's still people that won't buy that. These things can't talk. They've got to be just an ape in the woods, right? That's what people think. Well, some of them might be. I got to draw back just a little bit, because what we were dealing with up there was more than that, I guarantee it. Some very unusual phenomena went on with us up there. And it wasn't just the sounds, but it was other stuff too. And Al Berry experienced some of it, and he says, you know, just don't talk about this, otherwise you lose all credibility, because people weren't buying into UFOs, they weren't buying into aliens, they weren't buying into anything like that. In fact, they weren't buying into Bigfoot. So, you know, if you start talking about this stuff, we were businessmen. I mean, I was a businessman. I had over 200 employees one time, and so was Bill, my good friend. He was a contractor, a general contractor, and the other guys were substantial people in the community, and they don't want people laughing at you. And Al Berry, he's the one that stuck his neck out and fostered these studies at the University of Wyoming and really went for it, because he finally got convinced that probably no one was pulling their leg up there, that something really, really genuine was going on. And it really was. So, you know, I just read I was looking up to see where my site was on the internet, and I seen this one woman from Skeptical or Scientific America or something like that. Her name's Karen something. She was saying how this is a hoax. She's a linguist. And how can she possibly say that when she has no idea, no clue of what was really going on up there? She don't know. She's never studied the sounds. But she's a PhD, so she comes out with some statement like that just because her parameters in her studies says that only humans have the FOXP2 gene and that we have the mechanism for vocal, for language, like we do. But that's not true. These things have the same hyoid bone, which contributes to human language. So it gets deeper, but for some people to write it off as a hoax, it shows their ignorance, basically. And she hasn't responded to me yet, but I wrote her. I said, you know, you really should learn to know the facts before you start talking about this stuff, because it kind of bothers you when you've had so much work in this. 40, some almost 50 years I've been doing this, and you know, we've just gone through all the gamuts that we can go through. And you come out with somebody like that who just says, oh, it can't be, when people are going to listen to you if you've got a PhD behind you. And unfortunately, some people just can't buy into it because their discipline doesn't allow it.
I mean, that's also the other aspect that you touched on briefly there on. At the end of the day, I'm always, I wouldn't say in awe, but I'm always very impressed with anybody that's brave enough to come forward with any kind of scenario similar to yourself, you know, be it a ghost or a UFO or something, that someone sees something so remarkable that they know that if they tell anybody, they're going to be met with derision, you know, or pure skepticism and just called out on it. Did you, obviously, when it was first occurring, did you just basically keep it between yourselves, and how did Al get involved in regards to coming on board in regards to it, or did you all kind of sit on it for a long period and then it all came out?
We sat on it for a long time. We let Al Berry carry that mantle. He's the one who took it to the University of Wyoming, tried to get people, professional people, to look at it, and got laughed at a lot, got written up a lot for. But he had a master's degree in science. You know, the guy's no dummy. He's a big man, too, 6'4". He passed away in 2012, and him and I became good friends. But he wrote about our story in a book, with co-authored it with Ann Slade. And, you know, he was just real sincere. He's a good writer, too. And he's the one that took the flack. And after so many years, when he talked to me and we decided just to get out and start talking about this stuff, and I decided, who cares? You know, I don't need anybody's whatever it is. I don't need it.
Yeah.
I can do what I want to do, and this is what I wanted to do. So that's what I'm doing now, and I don't mind at all. I'm 77 years old now. I've been through the gauntlet. I can't imagine any question that's been asked me that I haven't tried to answer to the best of my knowledge. It's brought me into a whole field of science that I never thought I didn't even realize existed, and most people don't know about it today, and that's quantum science, and how they do what they do, how the strange things goes on. So for someone to laugh at somebody else just because they don't know or don't believe them is ludicrous. They shouldn't do that, because you got to understand what's going on. The paranormal is only normal. It's only paranormal because you don't understand it. Once you understand the science behind it, it becomes better to you. And you can see how things work, how things really work in the universe. And that's what I got into with my second book, The Quantum Bigfoot. It is how I think these things do what they do, because they were doing all kinds of stuff to us up there that we just, man, how'd they know that? How'd they do that? Or did they do that? Or what happened? We're talking about balls of light, and I don't mean just orbs, I mean things. I'm talking about sounds that was not language, not vocalizations, but just like a tuning fork, maybe a 5-ton tuning fork, something like that, above your head in the daytime, and you can't see the source of it, you can't find it. Things like that. And I tell people too, there's one time when I was inside this shelter. Now, keep in mind, we're 8 miles into the wilderness, very remote, composing area, and you hear a car door slam outside the shelter door. Well, how do you explain that? You can't, not through classical science, not through classical means. But there is a science that can explain some of those things, and it's quantum science, how the other dimensions exist, how things are out there that we just don't see in our limited parameters of light. And we only see in 3 dimensions, and there's a whole lot more going on.
Absolutely.
And that's where ghosts come in to play there. People see that stuff, and yet they tell somebody, and they're going to get laughed at. Well, the person that's laughing is the fool, because they're the ones that need to just understand how it could be.
Absolutely, very much. I mean, it always reminds me of a quote from Arthur C. Clarke from a few decades ago, where he said, technology from an advanced civilization would appear like magic to anybody on this planet. And, oh. I think that's quite true, because it often frustrates me when people talk about a variety of scientific subjects as if we are the be-all and end-all of science. And everything that we know explains everything in the universe, which I find both perplexing and rather narrow-minded, in the fact that we constantly see the parameters in a variety of disciplines change, Ron, as we gain more knowledge and we learn things. You could look at any scientific breakthrough over the last 50 years, and you could probably say to somebody 50 years ago what we can do now, and they would laugh at you. If you could tell somebody that you could have a supercomputer in your pocket, you know, even something as similar as a cell phone, if you'd have told somebody like that 30 years ago, they'd have thought you were crazy.
You're right on it, Paul. I mean, what you're saying is true. Changing. Science is supposed to be discovering things, and yet they close their classical science closes their head to quantum science. They won't let the bridges cross over. They say, well, quantum science only is effective in the micro world. Well, that can't be true. It's either true or it's not true. You know, science is science, and it goes throughout the universe, and you get to, let me quote this from Wayne Dreyer. Said this. He said, the highest form of ignorance is when you reject something you don't know anything about. And that gets right to what we just talked about. But you've got also, Edgar Mitchell, you know, he's a doctor, Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut. And he said, it takes classical and quantum sciences together to have clear perception. I love that quote. Because you can't ignore what you're seeing with your eyes, but you got to understand there's more going on than what you see. And once you accept that and realize that, you're not afraid of it anymore. You know, you just have to understand that it's there. There's things going on, and you got to open your head up, because there is a way to enter into that realm. And I've got my own method, but some people have their own method of how they can do some special things, but it's not that special once you understand it.
Absolutely.
Anyway, I'm chattering on. If I get carried away, just stop
right.
me.
Don't worry, it's Hulk. Thoroughly interesting. You're absolutely fine, Ron. So, going back to how it all started, then I'll introduce a clip in a little bit in a moment, and then you can discuss, you know, the where and when of that. But how long would you say, you know, on that first event, how long was it till you guys became convinced that something strange was really going on?
Well, we were convinced pretty soon something strange was going on. You mean something paranormal or something just...
Either or.
Yeah. Well, Bigfoot's strange in and of itself.
Yeah.
What are they, and what are they doing here, and how come they're so elusive, and how come we can't find the bones or body or something, you know, or how come they don't come out and let us know they're around? Well, there's an answer to that. And I get into that, but it's a long answer. We became aware something was pretty unique when we were there right off the bat, but Al Berry wasn't. He kept trying to uncover who's rigging up wire somewhere or something. In fact, we even took a wildlife biologist up there to do a flora flanta study on the terrain and at the advice of a scientist. So he dug trenches around looking for potential wires that were buried or any marks in the trees where speakers could have been hung or something like that. But, you know, all that stuff's been studied now, and we've got science behind us. And I say science, it's just a little outside the classical science parameters. And that's what people, I hope, you've got to have an open mind for this stuff. Because if you don't have an open mind, you're never going to conceive it, because you'll never understand it, but you can conceive it. And once you get past those marks and realize that, this was a real thing.
Yeah,
it really happened to us.
I mean, that's the other aspect as well. We've got to remember as well that, you know, this began in 1971.
Correct.
The technology for anybody to even perpetuate a hoax on this scale probably wasn't there either. Because, you know, with the greatest respect... You know, when we were discussing this at the beginning, you know, at the top of the show, you were explaining the difficulties you would have getting in there even on a horse. So we've then got to contemplate, if we are following a hoax situation here, that someone has had the guts to ride into this terrain to such an elevation, carrying what would have been an extremely clumpy piece of kit, and be able to fit it there without anybody else seeing them and get back out of there. That explanation alone, I often find in certain situations, is perhaps more perplexing than suggesting that somebody experienced something rather strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Alberi always thought it would be a better story if he could find out something like that. But we were all looking for tracks all the time, anybody around the area or something like that, and nobody ever was but us. And it's just a place that's a beautiful area, pristine, and hunting was fantastic there. And it's just, you could walk in, and we've walked in. That's why we take mules sometimes to carry our supplies. We took these barrels in on mules and wrapped them up really tight so the bears couldn't get into them and during the winter. And then we'd have our supplies, our sleeping bags, things like that there when we got there if we wanted to walk in. So anybody could walk in or ride in, but either way you're going to leave a track or something, some kind of sign. And also, it was studied for 60-cycle hum in the recordings, because they're cassette recordings. And I had the best recorder you could get at the time, battery-operated, and so did Alberi. He had a little Sony, but I had a big RCA, not big, but it was a real nice stereo set. And I had some fantastic recordings that got burned in a house fire, unfortunately. But a lot of them were copied and saved and what have you. But anyway... For someone, you know, the 60-cycle hum would have showed that it was pre-recorded. And it was shown that it wasn't pre-recorded, because there was no 60-cycle hum. And even the I.E. Tybel in New York City, before he found Dr. Curlin at the University of Wyoming, he sent the tapes back there trying to solicit their help. Well, they didn't write him off. They listened to it. And they said, well, there's no 60-cycle hum in it. You know, if you want to pay us this much money, we'll work on it. But they're the ones that studied the Nixon tapes, you know. They were top-notch at the time. And,
yep.
They said, you know, you need to find a university someplace that will study this, an electrical engineer. And that's what Alberi ended up doing. But again, he took a lot of ridicule to start off with, but he handled it well. You know, he's a man's man. And he was in the war. He was in Vietnam. He got shot at a lot. And he faced up to it all. I love the man. He was a good guy.
Yeah, but I think that just shows the level of tenacity that he had, that regardless of the ridicule, he was prepared to stand by it because he was convinced something strange had happened.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
Good.
And he didn't care if they dispelled it. If they could figure out what's wrong with it, that'd been all right with him too. He just wanted to find the truth, you know, one way or the other. But he needed a PhD, electrical engineer, to say that and to do what they did, a year-long study. And to come out with what they came out with. And that was written in a book, too, called Man Like Monsters on Trial by Dr. Curlin, who University of Wyoming. And he presented at the Anthropology of the Unknown in British Columbia. And it came out in that book, Man Like Monsters on Trial, his whole study. And he presented it to the group up there. One of the first ones in 1978, I think, that was ever conducted. It was in British Columbia. And anyway, there's a lot of history behind all this. And someone like, you know, to come out and say, oh, it's a hoax, these guys got fooled somebody, you know, that like telling us we've been on a turnip truck or something somewhere. You know, we're not dummies. We're looking for stuff.
Absolutely.
But we knew something big was up there, leaving some big tracks, making a big voice, and was seen occasionally, but just glimpses. That's all you could get. These things don't come out and let you look at them.
Absolutely. Right. So let's have a look at one of the recordings you did. This one's called Rapid Fire. So I'll play the clip, and then you can give us some background afterwards, if that's all right with you.
Okay. Just before, there's two of them talking, I think, in this clip, but at each other. At the time, we didn't know if they were, this is in 72, I think it was, we didn't know if they were talking about who's going to come in and eat us, or if they were arguing over the food that was outside, because you don't know what you're dealing with. We were in there, by the way, speaking of somebody hoaxing us, we're all got guns.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're ready to shoot at something if it bothers us.
Absolutely.
And so it would be ludicrous to someone to Well, anyway.
Even on that level, just before we dive into it, that alone, you know, once again, Ron, I mean, that would be suicidal.
Yes, it could be.
Right, to the clip, sir. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you. I mean, if I heard that late at night, Ron, with the greatest respect, you wouldn't see me for dust.
I mean, well, you wouldn't want to get out of that shelter if something like that was going on right outside of the shelter walls.
I mean, I didn't realize how aggressive one of those voices sounds, because one of them sounds really angry.
Yeah, you don't know either is what you're dealing with. You don't know, and that's why we're all in there with our weapons ready, and... You know, they never crashed in the shelter through those log walls, and we didn't shoot at them, so they kept coming back. And that was interesting times, really.
I mean, was that, you know, as you were saying, the more you kind of came, you got the impression, not, you know, no one wants to make an assumption here, because, you know, we are considering things that, you know, we have no tangible, you know, acceptance that, our assumption that they seem to get used to you was true, but how was the first sort of few days and your first few interactions of a similar nature in that kind of aggression coming through, Ron?
Yes. Well, the first couple of years, that's just how it was. These were made in 72, and those sounds you just heard, and they started all this in 71. So... I say they because we believe there was a family of them up there. Different sized tracks were around. And it was very aggressive during the first. And you can't help but get a little concerned. You know, you still don't know. It's just exciting. You feel like you're in a Wild West program or something. But in real life.
Absolutely. And I think the other, I mean, you know, when we talk about the linguistics of what we hear there, there seems to be an acceleration as well, which tends to play towards an aggressive response, because usually if your conversation becomes accelerated, it's usually because you're excited or you're angry or you're sad. There is an emotional response in that kind of way you would talk, would you not say, Ron?
All their chatter was real rapid, and that's something we noticed between themselves or wherever we heard it. It's just a rapid chatter. And this was also brought out in John Green's book, Apes Among Us. He interviewed a guy named Albert Osman. Mm. And Albert Osman was supposedly kidnapped and carried away by a male in a sleeping bag. Yep. And was held captive for 6 days. And some people know this story, some people don't. But he said in his interview that they were chattering amongst themselves. There was a male, a female, and two adolescents in this area in British Columbia. And he was held there for 6 days until he escaped. And he goes through quite detail on what he's seen when he's running out, what's going on there. And one of the details that I really took note of was they were chattering amongst themselves. People, when they hear this chattering, it's something you can't understand. It's real rapid. And it wasn't until 74, which you'll have those tapes on in a few minutes, but when they, the cryptolinguists thinks that they slowed their vocal mechanism down to possibly trying to communicate with us, realizing we couldn't understand the rapid chatter. So they were talking to me or yelling at me or something, and I don't know what they were saying, but I responded back to them and got some really interesting reaction out of that night. And it was just two of us in camp, but it was quite an exciting night. Plus, that was the night I got to see one, which was pretty cool. Been waiting a long time for that.
Yeah, I can imagine. So, I mean, the first time I ever heard the Sierra Sounds as they're now collectively known, I'll be brutally honest with you, Ron, it sent shivers up my spine. So, you know, fair play for you for going back. I think it's the key thing, because I think a lot of people, I mean, do you think that's a lot of people have a similar situation and don't respond to it in the positive way that you did initially, Ron? That they basically go, oh, you know, we're not staying here anymore, we're off.
Absolutely. I hear reports of that all the time. Oh, well, we was out there playing your sounds or doing something, and this thing come crashing through the trees at us. I say, we're out of there. And they're gone. Well, why? You know, these things are just like a bluff charge, I think, when they do that. They never did that with us, never charged in. They were just there and waiting for us to get inside the shelter. But anyway, yeah, a lot of people, they do. They'll run away. They call themselves researchers, but if you really want to research, you want to study and see what's going on, what's really these things are all about. You don't run away from them. Of course, when I was 29 when this started, 29 years old, and you're invulnerable then.
Yes.
You think you are, and you think the gun's going to stop them, which I'm not so sure it would have, but you feel comfortable with a 44 Magnum on your hip and, you know, all this stuff around you, these other gun power. We'd all been deaf right now if we had to shoot our way out of there, though. But anyway, it was exciting times, and it's still exciting. I was up there last year again.
I mean, it's always been, I've always found it intriguing, and you refer to Albert Osman there, which has always been an extremely peculiar case. More so, I always remember, I think he escaped because I think the one that he considered to be the male was was it his snuff he was really intrigued with, and he thought, oh, I'll have some of that, and then he drank loads of coffee and he went on a tiz apparently because he'd had a really bad reaction to it, and Osman was able to escape, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. In fact, I flew up there researching the Albert Osman story with Peter Byrne and Al Berry and filmer. And we flew into Toba Inlet and we was looking for the place where he claims he was being held, you know, the bowl, the 10-acre bowl, and trying to analyze the time of the year and what he said he's seen and all that. And I got a whole chapter about that in my latest book. It's quite a compelling story because nobody thinks he was lying. John Green, I talked to John about it, and John said he thought I would thought Albert Osman was lying to him. And I said, no, I don't think he's lying. I think he just might have been mistaken about Toba Inlet because it doesn't make sense. He had this Indian row him up the water up there to Toba Inlet, dropped him off, and the timing didn't work. I dropped my airplane down into the canyon and looked out at the 1,000-foot level where he said he could see the ships. You can't see the ships at that level. There's things that just didn't add up for that inlet. So we determined, after all, we talked about it a lot and flew over that area for hours and hours. And we had helicopters on standby at Camel River, so we was ready to drop in there, you know. If we could have found the bowl, then we would look for artifacts, you know, like snuff can leftovers or something like that. But we couldn't find the bowl, so we determined it was a different inlet, a little closer down, because it made more sense, and that's what I think. I think when John Green interviewed him, which was close to 30 years later, you know, in the early 50s, I think Albert Osman just pointed on the map and said, that's where I was, and looked at the inlet, and it was Toba Inlet. I'm not so sure he was really at Toba Inlet. I just don't think that part adds up. But his story is a good one, and it's pretty much accredited as being genuine because he was so detailed on everything. And so I think he was just mistaken on the inlet, and of course, Peter wanted to go back up there and then search for it again for the other areas. But again, it takes a lot of time and money and stuff like that to fly my plane around. So I I said, well, if you want to pay for the gas, we can go.
Well, fair enough. If you're playing your rules wrong, I think that's the simple.
I'm the pilot.
Absolutely. You get people to pay for the fuel and you choose the tunes, and that's how it should usually work, my friend. So, I mean, yeah, I've always found the Osman case very just so strange that it's not something you can just dismiss straight out of hand, because it is a very peculiar. It's very similar for me with the Ape Canyon story, because it's so peculiar. And so out of place and out of time.
Fred Beck, that was the same year, you know, the Ape Canyon and Mount St. Helens. And he claims he shot one dead on, did not miss, and they couldn't find the body.
Yep.
So, you know, all this adds up to my theory, da-da-da-da.
Very true.
Because Albert Osman went to his grave, not Albert, but Fred Beck went to his grave saying these things are paranormal. Because they had been messing with him for a couple of years there at that mining camp at Mount St. Helens. And they followed a trackway one time that just abruptly stopped. Hmm. And that's when there's some strange going on here. But you know, I've had people over the years, when I interview people, I had them tell me, you know, these tracks just stopped. And how do you find one track and then all of a sudden it doesn't go anywhere? Well, I used to just write those people off and say, well, you're mistaken. They probably jumped to a rock. They probably climbed a tree. That is something to get out of leaving tracks. But that happened to me. And once it happens to you, in fact, I'll say this to anybody, until you've experienced something unusual like that you can't explain, you won't have an open mind. You'll think there's an explanation for everything. Well, the explanation for this lies in quantum theory. And I had it happen to me. My daughter had saw one of these when we were out close to camp, and we found the trackway, and it was deep, and this whatever made this thing was bipedal, and it was really heavy, and all of a sudden it just stopped. Okay, here it is, happening to me. Well, I looked up the trees. I couldn't see any tree that could support something like that at the time, and I looked for boulders. They've jumped to a boulder. What happened? How the trackway just stopped, because we followed for a little ways, and it just stopped. Well, again, I think these things somehow, they've been here longer than Homo sapiens, I think, anyway. And, of course, I get into the DNA manipulation from alien intervention into primates and stuff like that, which probably gave them some attributes that we still lack understanding. I don't think we're short on them. We just don't understand them, and we haven't been able to access them. That's my opinion anyway. But they can manipulate energy and transfer somehow their energy, which we're all made of, by the way, into matter. And if you can find the frequency of the energy that you're working with, you can change the matter that it's made of. So that's quantum theory. That's, when I say theory, I'm explaining theory. So, well, it's just a theory, da-da-da-da. Well, no. Quantum theory is different than classical science, because classical science, you know, everything's measurable, predictable, everything is material or physical, everything is, it's Newtonian physics, and that's what we're all taught in school. But you get into quantum science, which takes over, that's why Einstein studied, and that's why these people 100 years ago came up with this stuff, and it's all established by mathematics. And mathematics, in order to disprove it, you have to disprove it mathematically. See where it's fouled, where it's flawed, where what's going on. And that hasn't, you know, these other dimensions exist. So even though it's called quantum theory, it's not considered the same as a regular theory like you'd see in the classical parameters. So when people say, well, it's just a theory, well, that's because you don't see it. And until you can see it, they're not going to believe it. That's why I say when people get out there and something strange happens to them that just doesn't make any sense at all, anything they can figure out, you got to keep an open mind, because there's things going on that we don't see. And just understand that there's laws in the universe that are working all the time inside us, inside this world, inside the universe. And it's just all happening, and you got to open your mind up. Unless you got an open mind, it's going to be hard to swallow some of this.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is, because the other aspect to this as well, Ron, is that obviously since your involvement, you know, back at the beginning of the 70s, there has been numerous scientific theories and breakthroughs pushed forward. I know you refer to dark matter in the book, which is, which is, you know, a tangible scientific theory, and it essentially has quadrupled the size of the universe, because until it was discovered, they couldn't understand why certain laws didn't work in certain areas. So that alone has given us a whole new branch of science to explore and to understand how that actually physically can alter our reality, even though it, you know, technically it's immeasurable currently because of our limits scientifically. But we also know that the growing theory about additional dimensions has seen multiple people over the last few years put forward, you know, that there are numerous dimensions perhaps coexisting, and it's that is somehow causing frictions against each side, and occasionally the rift appears, and that I find a perplexing denial of certain aspects, because people are talking about these things, but when you discuss, you know, the subjects that we're interested in, Ron, people just dismiss them out of hand without considering the other aspect.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I say, the height of ignorance is something you don't know anything about. So that's what I started trying to do, is figure out how this stuff happened, how this happened to us up there at the camp. The quantum science seems to have the answer to that. How things are out there that you just need to, well, better understand. What are these things all about? We live in a kind of a bubble, it seems like, the culture we're in. And you think that everything exists, or that we're the smartest things going on, and we're not. I think these things have learned, have evolved possibly into something that maybe we will evolve into someday too. We're just not as smart as we think we are. Mm-hmm. We're not as intuitive as we think we are. But these things are very intuitive, whatever they are. And I think there's different types of them, and I get into that too in my book, because I base that on my interviews over the years, what's happened to me, what I've seen with my own eyes in Peru, Bolivia, and different places. I've been all over the world researching this stuff. The aliens have definitely been here. There's no doubt. It's established scientifically. I've seen their remains with two different scientists on two different expeditions in Bolivia and in Peru. And when you see that stuff with your own eyes and try to understand what's really going on, you realize something is ahead of us, or has been ahead of us. Mm. And did they, with this advanced technology, manipulate the DNA of something? As you get into Greek mythology about the demigods, and you see the statues over in Egypt, you know, animal heads on these beings. And I think probably they've had a ball. Just come down different aliens playing around, trying to do different things with different animals. And Bigfoot might be a remnant of something like that. But again, over eons, I think they probably, some of them have crossbred with humans, which would give them 23 chromosomes, sets of chromosomes, instead of 24 like the great apes, most of the other great apes have. And that would allow them to crossbreed. And you find that any DNA that's been studied, which it has been studied, and they come up with a human component into the mitochondrial, which is the maternal side of the DNA, which means it would have been from the female, carries right on through. So once the classical world gets a hold of that, and they say, well, it's got human DNA, and it has to be contaminated, and that's where they go with it. So they don't accept that findings of the geneticists that have been studying this and looking into it seriously. And it's just too bad, because until classical science opens their mind, they're not gonna get anywhere.
Yeah, I mean it is.
In my opinion.
Yeah, I mean it is. It's very interesting. Essentially, it's painting a picture that we were a galactic island of Dr. Moreau, really. That you know, certain different species turned up, and they all had a different idea of what they fancied. And it's incredible, because I mean even if you look at basic humanity, Ron, over the last 20 years, we've discovered four new species of humans, which 25 years ago, it was humans and Neanderthals died out because they were stupid. Now we know. But that, you know what I mean? We're talking about something as simple as evolution in that aspect, Ron. You know, now we understand that humans, Denisovans, and Neanderthals were all crossbreeding, And then we've had Homo floresiensis pop up, and then we've found another two species as well out in, you know, in the Pacific. And so the change from what was accepted 30 years ago has completely been turned on its head. You know, Neanderthals didn't die out. They were breeding alongside what we are today, and people right. still carry the gene.
Yes,
so
yeah.
It frustrates me that, you know, 30 years ago people were saying to anybody, oh, there was different strands of people. No, you're all idiots, you're stupid. And yet, you know, we've moved on. We've found four new versions or species, and yet everything else is wrong still. And that's just because it contradicts itself.
Yeah, let's just hope another 30 years from now we'll look back on something like this and we'll like, wait, maybe those guys were onto something. You know?
Well, I hope so. So let's have a listen to another clip, if that's all right with you, Ron.
Yes, right.
Go on.
Is the whistle interaction, is that the one you're going to do?
It certainly is, yeah.
Yeah. So, that was also made in 72, and this is one of the first times they started interacting with Warren Johnson's little voice you'll hear behind this. Mm. He was trying to coach him in and out into view. Val Berry, I believe, was up trying to get a picture of one. But they seem to be very intuitive to the human exploitation. They don't want their picture taken. Maybe the bad hair day or something. I don't know. But anyway, you'll hear the whistle, but the whistle also turns into some vocalization. So.
Certainly. Thank you very much. That's right. Here we are. This is the whistle interaction. Well,
yeah, that was Warren Johnson, who's passed away now, but he was kind of the leader of the group, and we had just one voice at that time conversing. When Warren was there, he would be the one that would try to coach him and talk to him something, because we still trying to get him to come out into the open so we could get a picture, because people wonder, well, if you had that kind of interaction, you should have got a picture. Well, they're not some dumb ape or some dumb bear that you can just get a picture of. These things are very sapient, I believe, and that puts them in the line with what I talked about, the mitochondrial DNA. If they are part human, then that would explain a lot of the attributes they seem to have. But the whistle, we also found out through the studies that the whistle is done through the vocal mechanism, through the throat, and not through the lips like we whistle. We whistle through the lips, and you can hear Warren whistling back at it, but it would whistle through its vocal mechanism and not through the lips, according to the study.
So that would be, what has it been compared, because the only comparable thing I can think of straight away is obviously Mongolian throat singing,
right? Yeah, I've heard them, which
mm-hmm. is incredible. If you've never seen it or heard it, it sounds like nothing on earth, and it's all done in a completely, you know, no use of the tongue or anything. It's an extremely strange, I mean, it's very beautiful and hypnotic.
It very much is, yes. Very nice.
It's one of those questions. I love things like that, Ron, because it makes me think, well, how on earth did they just decide to do that and nobody else in the world did? I just think it's wonderful.
I think it carries better through the atmosphere.
Mm.
And that's the theory I've heard. You know, that they do that to connect with others. And it is very beautiful. If nobody's heard it, I suggest they listen to it, and throat singers, because they can. It's just remarkable.
Oh, very much so. So, obviously, the thing that strikes me out of that clip as well is that the conversation coming from yourselves, it seemed very. It reminded me, and I don't mean this disrespectfully at all, but it reminds me in the way I would talk to my dog. Do you know what I mean? In a kind of calm voice, because that's
come on, boy,
yeah,
come on down.
just
yeah,
trying...
well, we thought of them. Like I say, we was underestimating what they were at the time. We were thinking of them something inferior to us, and we was coaching them in like you would a dog or like you would an animal of some type. But that's not what was going on. I mean, that's what was going on, but that's not what happened. We didn't coach them in. You couldn't get them to come out and expose themselves hardly ever. If you've seen one, it's generally by accident or unless they wanted you to get a glimpse. My daughter got a really good view of one up there once, and she gave a pretty good description of it. Just her and I were in camp. We'd walked in. So, anyway, she saw them three different times, and she's the one that saw one that morning, too, when we followed the trackway. Mm. And so, anyway, it's interesting stuff.
Absolutely. And, I mean, this continued for... I mean, how many times have you been back to the camp, Ron, either with the original group or with other people over the years?
I haven't counted. Multiple.
Too many.
I mean, I used to go up there every chance I get, but I didn't keep track of it. Too many to count. Every chance I got, I would go up there, and if I could find someone to go with me. A time or two, I went up there by myself, which is not a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. There's one other study that came out, which isn't professional, but it's a very good, done by Thinker Thunker. I don't know if you ever heard of him or not on the Sierra Sounds.
Yeah.
Thinker/Thunker, you can Google that. But he did a 20-minute analysis. I imagine it took him longer than that, but his little... spit on the internet is 20 minutes long, and it talks about how the sounds that he's got, which we knew you can't mimic these, a human being can't make these tones, but he says there's actually five octaves in one tone, and it's throughout our sounds. And if you listen to that Thinker/Sierra Sounds, it's just a really good analogy. I need to find a bioacoustical engineer at some university that can substantiate that or not, so I could use it, because it's incredible if it's true. He says no known animal or human being on this earth can do more than three octaves in one tone. These can do five. So I think they have a real complex vocal mechanism. There's times when we thought our camp was being torn apart. I mean, the barrels were being, all the food being drunk out, cans being thrown everywhere, and you look out there later on and nothing's changed. And I'd explain that. It's either done through the vocal mechanism or they're hypnotizing all of us at the same time inside the shelter. Don't know. But it's one of those sounds that we just couldn't explain. And there's a lot of things like that happen up there. And so it gets into what people would call the paranormal, the woo. I parallel paranormal and woo with quantum physics. And I think quantum physics answers a lot of stuff that people are now calling it. It's the new woo with quantum physics, by the way.
It's one of those things, I know, because I think it was it R. Scott Nelson that mentioned the vocal range was also lower and higher than has ever been measured in a human.
Right, it is. It's lower and higher and in our vocal range. It's also, that was established by Dr. Curlin's report in 1978, and he shows it in a graph in the book I mentioned, Man Like Monsters on Trial. So he shows the graph as the tone. He takes out this one sound that he studied for that one graph and showed where the vocal range was way up above it, in it, and below it. I play that sound in my PowerPoint program when I give my conference speeches and show where the human voice is in this box. And you can see where the animal that's making this sound goes into that, and it goes below it, and it goes above it. And quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I think I've seen one of your presentations on YouTube, and you put that up as one of you as part of the presentation. It is a fascinating piece of evidence, because once again, how are we able to mimic that sound? You know, and I'm sure. It wouldn't surprise me if somebody had claimed that you'd run across a runaway lyrebird or something, Ron, because I'm sure skeptics will come up with a variety of excuses.
Well, all you got to do is show me. Just show me. Show me. You know, if you, anybody can reproduce these sounds, you know, they get a medal. These sounds have been around for, like I said, close to 50 years, and no one's been able to do just what you're mentioning there. A human sound expert listened to them years ago before Scott Nelson got a hold of them, actually. And she was one of only 10 in California that could was a court-certified interpreter in several languages, had perfect tone, perfect hearing. And she said, nobody can duplicate this. She challenges anyone to try to duplicate these sounds because it just can't be done humanly. And if Thinker Thunker's onto it here, then that's true. And I'd love to have a bioacoustical engineer at some university take this on and do another study because I want to know too. You know, if they can change their vibrational frequency and change it enough to actually change their energy somehow. I don't know. I'm curious as anybody about what's really going on. I think I'm onto some kind of a picture here that I'm trying to produce, or not trying to produce, but the dots are leading me to a picture, let me put it that way. And this is just another one of those dots that says they have a very complex vocal mechanism able, and I think we have two vocal cords, right?
Yep.
Well, these things may have more. And how'd they get that? Did they get it through evolution? Because I believe in evolution. I just think something's been monkeying around with DNA on different primates, different animals. And that gets into Greek mythology and all that. And some advanced technology has done that. We can manipulate DNA now, but we're not as capable probably as some space traveler or something. And I won't get laughed off the program here, but...
No, don't be daft. I mean, if you've got the technology to fly halfway around the universe, I'm quite sure you're probably quite good at other things as well, Ron.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and that, you know, that alone just... I find it, you know, like I say, you've got scientific proof by linguistics and vocal experts that prove that these recordings are not faked, could not be faked, and can't be reproduced by a human being.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but you still got scientists and people who, like that person I was talking about, that Karen from that Scientific America, what it is, who makes that stupid statement. How could she come up with something like that when she hasn't even paid attention to it? She don't have the facts right. She don't have anything right. She's just most likely a hoax.
Well,
that's how they cover their tracks. You know, that's how they keep their tenure going. That's how they keep their money coming in for the projects and stuff like that. So,
it's always happened. I mean, the coelacanth is a prime example, Ron, that it was completely dismissed out of hand until a white scientist found one. And then, they existed. But the people of the area had said that these fish had always been there. But no, it was a wild story. And you can trace that back to, you know, the stories of the mountain gorilla and the panda.
Mountain gorilla was what, 1904 before they accepted that?
Yeah. I think what the panda, the first, it took them 60 years to find a panda.
Otherwise, they don't exist. Yeah, well, that's exactly what they say.
Exactly. And I think the most recent one is the stories of the Billy apes in Africa, which were a fearsome tribe of chimpanzees that would attack lions that everybody said, oh, it's just absolute nonsense, that, till they saw it. And then they were like, oh my God. But as soon as we discover these things, it's all the dismissal and skepticism seems to vanish. Have you ever noticed?
I've noticed that. Have you? Oh, that's very observant. I just want to keep doing what I'm doing here and hope it rings some bells somewhere and some people open up their heads, because too many people run around with a closed mind and think that we all live in a little, they're in a bubble.
I mean, I don't. You've always, as well, the other thing that I've always found fascinating about you, Ron, is that you've always said that you're not bothered what it is as long as you know what the truth is. You're just searching for the answer. So for you, all possibilities are on the table.
Absolutely. Yeah, you got to have, I'm ready. Stephen Hawkins, you know, the famed Stephen Hawkins who passed away last year, he said energy can't die. Well, at our most minute level of existence, we all are energy. And that can't die, according to Stephen Hawkins. And then you get into even the biblical things, you know, people say, well, you're going to go to heaven when you die. Well, what goes to heaven? You know, you go to another dimension. You know, what religions call heaven, I call another dimension. And anyway, it just goes on and on with stuff like that. I think there's a lot to be said about spirituality and quantum physics is all on the same plane. And it's...
Well, I think that touches on several realms of the paranormal, you know, as well as what you say there, Ron, you know, even on a religious level, you look at Buddhism, which has a consistent belief in reincarnation, which is essentially the transfer of energy, if you want to put it down to a basic thing, because, as you refer to, it has to go somewhere. It can never die. It just changes and comes across. Mm-hmm. When you accept that, then leads you into a whole new field, because it touches, like I say, it not just touches on religion and spirituality, but it also touches on paranormal events and cryptid events. Are these all different forms of energy? We just don't have the comprehension to understand the information we're given.
Yeah. You know who did? Is Nikola Tesla. He had a statement. He said, quantum physics and spirituality are the same. I mean... What one man calls paranormal, another man calls quantum physics. What he actually said was, what one man calls God, another man calls quantum physics.
Mm. Absolutely. Oh, dear me. Right, let's have another clip, if that's all right with you.
Mm-hmm.
And this one's called the Apala question. So what was happening here then, Ron?
This is the night when they started interacting with us outside the shelter. This was in 1974. This is the night I got to see what was making the sound, which was pretty critical. Some people say, well, you didn't see what was making the sound. You don't know what made the sound. Well, that's kind of true in a way. You got to see what's making the sound to know. Well, I seen this thing, and it was going through the trees, bright moonlit night, inhumanly fast and smooth. And it was asking me the Pollock question. Happened the same night. I'm not sure this is the same time, but the same night. It was asking me something, and I was trying to mimic it back again, not knowing exactly what they were saying. I was just mimicking. It sounds like they got kind of a reaction to that. I mean, an interesting reaction. Go ahead and play it.
Certainly will. Thank you very much. Right, here we go. I mean, that's incredible, because there's mm-hmm. clearly some kind of response going on there.
Yeah, if you play that other one, the next one, Talk to Us, I think.
Yeah, certainly.
It's a little bit longer, but it gives a little more of a,
yeah, certainly. I'll dive straight into that one, then, Ron, if you want. If that's okay.
Yeah, before our time's up here.
Yeah, no problems. Absolutely. Right, let's play that one. Goodness. I mean, that also as well, I've heard it, and I don't mean this disrespectfully either. They are the ones that where I think the term samurai talk, is it sort of came forwards?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess you didn't have all that clip I sent, or I didn't send it all, one or the other.
That's okay.
Yeah, the samurai cry is in there, and I somewhere, I got this on my... second CD that I sell, and it's the samurai. That's where the samurai term came from, because it sounds like a something crying, you know, big samurai cry. And anyway, that's that was turned actually by Matt Moneymaker, who was on that Finding Bigfoot program, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he started the BFRO.org, and he actually came up and seen me just before he started that website, and he listened to the sounds. He said, that sounds like a samurai cry. And so he coined that. I got to give him credit for that. And now it's gone viral with, oh, this is a samurai cry. I've heard samurai chatter. will tell me they hear a shamrock chatter all the time, but yeah. Not all the time, but chattering is what they do. And, at least some of them. I'm not sure all of them can talk, but what we dealt with does.
Yeah. So do you think that then in from 74 onwards, as you refer to, you got the impression that they were slowing down their conversation and they seem to be more accepting of you guys being in their area?
Oh, yes. In fact, actually, the cryptolinguist said that's what the same vocal mechanism made both sounds from the ones you heard earlier and these sounds here. They sound different. And I kept wondering, is it the same family of creatures? It's the same, because we know they were the big feet and they leave big tracks and they weren't fooling us, nobody. So was it the same family members? He said, it's the same vocal mechanism. So he seems to think that they were slowing their vocal chatter down to something we could possibly understand. Because when I started interacting with them that night, they responded with a lot of humor, actually, which you didn't get all that on that clip I sent you. But it was, I say humor, it almost sounded like it was humorous, like their response. But it's quite an exciting night.
I mean, I've always found this whole incident incredibly interesting, and that for me, even listening to the brief clips that you've very kindly supplied me this week, I can see that there's a change in the communication and the way they seem to be vocalizing, even from just the briefness of those, the sharpness of the earlier clip. Seems to have completely gone out, and it seems a bit more rounded. Yes, I know it still sounds a little bit choppy, but it's just seems a lot more pleasant.
Yeah, it did, and almost friendly. I think there was a young one there that night on my CD that comes with my book, Voices in the Wilderness, my first book I wrote. When you get to the context of sound, it gives you the sound, you can hear it. So there's a little voice in there, and I think there were three of them there that night. There was the male, the one that gave the samurai cry, and he was streaking down through the trees there to the other two, a young one and a mother. And we think maybe the young ones are getting bold. We're not sure what's going on. We don't know a lot, but I know they were there that night. There was probably three of them, and you can hear the young one do the little chatter, little voice, and then the big one coming down on it, like, don't do that. These guys are human. They're not to be trusted. They're screwing up the earth. Don't let them out.
I mean, that's the other aspect as well that makes it difficult to believe that anybody could have hoaxed it, because it's little things like that where you seem to have a juvenile and an adult conversing. I don't think a hoaxer would take the time to bother with.
Well, they wouldn't leave a little. I mean, we followed some tracks, 9-inch tracks, along with an 18-inch track in the snow up there. Now, come on. It had to be a small one and a big one. And we think it's the juvenile, because we heard the juvenile before. We just didn't record it. That night we got the recorded, so that was good. So anyway, they are procreating. So whatever they are, they're multiplying. Mm. And I think if they are interdimensional, which I tend to think probably some of them are, if not all of them, they have to stay in this three-dimensional world we live in to raise their young ones. That's my opinion. And to when they're going through their stages of pregnancy, they have to be in our three-dimensional environment. That's my theory.
So do you think that, obviously, getting to where you now feel your position on the subject is these days, Ron, was it the additional phenomena apart from the vocal, you know, obviously the what you would at first claim, you know, suggest was a physical presence that was vocalizing, communicating with rocks and rapping and moving things about, and you could hear them? When did the strange lights and noises that just were out of context start appearing?
Well, they were kind of in between it all. They were part of all this stuff. One night, Bill and I seen this big ball of light coming down. It looked like the moon was falling, except it was going slow. It was controlled, whatever it was, it blew. And we lost it behind the trees. That I would call that a UFO. because we couldn't identify it. It certainly wasn't a plane and nothing that we'd ever seen before. Mm-hmm. And but there was other lights that followed the Johnsons around up there, according to them, above their heads. And there's just other strange things. And all this phenomenon was happening when we were interacting with them and when we were trying to interact with them over the years. And I say over the years, that's the hardest part for people to grab. Well, these guys had to be faking it because they didn't get a picture. Well, you just don't go out and get a picture of these things. I challenge anybody to try to do that. They're too intuitive for that. They seem to, and I get into that quantum mind entanglement too. I think they can entangle you. There's times when Warren and I walking up to where one of these had to be behind this tree. We shot out of the shelter door right quick, thinking, okay, we're going to see it run away at bright moonlit night again. 8,400 feet, you can read a newspaper up there tonight. And we walked out, we started walking up towards this tree. And at that time, we figured they weren't going to eat us, or we'd already been eaten. So we started walking up this tree, towards this tree where we thought it was, sure enough, a huge tree, and run away. It didn't run away, but we got stopped by some type of, I explained it in my book as a force field of some type, like you'd think of in Star Trek. You don't see anything, but you can't move any further forward. And that happened to him and I both. We weren't talking to each other. And I brought this up to a scientist later on. He said, I don't want to hear about your fear. I said, we weren't afraid then. We really thought these things weren't going to hurt us. And Warren looked at me, and I looked at him. We were probably 10, 15 feet apart. And he said, I can't move anymore. And I said, I can't either. Go backwards, but you can't go forward. So he said, well, maybe it was pheromones, or maybe it was infrasound. Because if these things have the vocal mechanism, which is suggested by the studies, they may be into infrasound. And I imagine, if anybody looked at infrasound, large animals do that, elephants, giraffes, tigers. So I thought, well, it has to be infrasound then that stopped us, because pheromones only work within the same species. Well, now I find, or years later, I find that if there is a human component to it in the mitochondrial DNA, and they are part human, which I believe there are hybrids, I do believe that, and if that's the case, maybe it was pheromones. I don't know. We just don't know some of these answers, but there's a mystery there, and there's a mystery in a lot of places. People, every day I get emails and conversation from people wanting to tell me about their experience or what happened to them. And once they find I'm open-minded and will listen to them, I'll listen to them. Some of them, you know, they don't seem credible, but a lot of them do. And when they say I'm credible, I pay better attention to them. If you go to somebody's home that wants to give you a report and they got candles lit all around the room and got a bottle of whiskey over in the corner, you know, and they're talking about some plan, something, you got to just be open-minded, wonder, could that really be, or are these guys pulling my leg, or are they hallucinating stuff, you know? So it's all about credibility and trying to understand, I think.
Well, I think that is that. And that stands you in good stead as well, Ron, because it's very easy to accept everything you hear on face value and run with it regardless. And in this field, I don't think that's what I would recommend anybody do, to be fair. And it's I mean, did you find, I mean, when did you kind of as we come to the end, I mean, at what point did you kind of embrace the whole subject and decide to begin investigating other reports?
Oh, I've been doing that for years now. Once people knew I was into it, they wanted to share with me their experience. So it's been going on for 20, 30 years, maybe longer than that. As soon as I came out into the public, and I should say, come out of the closet, and people let people know that, you know, I'm a Bigfoot researcher. I want to hear your story. I want to know what you think and what happened to you. And I get this every day. Every day I get some in my emails or in my from my website, which, by the way, you haven't mentioned my website.
Yeah,
it's ronmorehead.com, and that's 1-0-M-O-R-E-H-A-D. And you can buy my CDs there. I got two CDs with the stories of Al Berry's story and my story, both 40 minutes long about. And I got my two books there, Voices in the Wilderness. It's my chronicle. I'm doing this for 40-some-odd years at that time when I wrote the book. And it comes with a CD, so when I get the context of the sounds, you can hear the sound. And then I got the latest one, which is the Quantum Bigfoot. I sell a lot of those, and they're all downloadable from my website, ronmorehead.com.
Fantastic.
So before you have a chance to ask me, I just told you.
Well, that's very kind of you, and thank you very much. And I recommend it all You know, your level of work and research is something I've always been greatly impressed with, Ron. Like I said to you right at the very beginning when we were chatting, it's a situation and a subject and a incident that has always thoroughly fascinated me. So when you look back now and look at cryptozoology now, and the way the field is moving, growing, expanding, what are your hopes and dreams for the next 10 years, or you know, what do you think about the current crop of researchers that have probably followed you through being inspired by people like yourself, Ron, and Peter Byrne and John Green?
You know, there's Russians are probably a little ahead of us on all this, because they accept these things and they accept the open-mindedness, and they're trying to create a whole new group with scientists where they will acknowledge quantum physics and acknowledge some of these reports that are coming in, because they're coming in by the groves. I mean, thousands of reports coming in about unusual aspects of this stuff. And until classical science stretches its parameters a little bit and gets out of their box, I call it a box because they're all disciplined and been trained that way. If you want your tenure in college, if you want your grants to come in, you better stay within this box, or you're going to get wrote off of all this. You're not going to be acknowledged. And Grover Krantz, who's a professor, retired from Washington State here, he died here in Squim, where I live, actually. And he took a ration for siding up with these things are out there, just that they're out there. He said, no, I believe, because there's the remnants of Gigantopithecus found in Southeast Asia, and he thinks that they were a remnant of that, and he had the artifacts from it. And he claimed that they were here, and if they were here, the Gigantopithecus, you know, they were 10, 12 foot tall if they stood upright. So he took a ration for even acknowledging that these things might exist, because, you know, we're smart. We know everything that's out there has to be known, right? Well, you got the Plesiosaurus, which was just discovered in Japan a few years back, and they thought those things had been extinct for a million years. You just got all kinds of things that are coming to light now, and I think more and more things are going to come to light. I think that's exactly what the Mayan calendar was all about for 2012, is we're all going to be enlightened, and I just love to be a part of it. I'm not after ego at all. I just want people to know that something's going on that they're not seeing with their regular three-dimensional eyes. Tesla says another thing that I like to quote: the day science begins to study non-physical phenomena, it will make more progress in one decade than in all the previous centuries of its existence. So that's a good statement.
I think it is, absolutely. And I think that's a good place to park it, Ron. Because obviously I can't thank you enough for spending some time talking to us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate you coming on.
You're very welcome. And like I say, you've given everybody the links for your website. So I will let you go, but I just wanted to say thank you again for your time. You take care. It's been absolutely lovely to speak to you, and thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate it. We'll be right back.